Mr. Henderson, Reel 8. You wanted to say something more about the 61st Training Regiment, Mr. Henderson.
Yes, it was a... Well, first of all, each regiment has its own dress. You can pick them out. We had, of course, the battle dress, blackberries, and the badge was a mailed fist, which was the Royal Armoured Corps, surrounded by two... They were like arrows, really. And that was the mailed fist which all armoured corps regiments had. On our shoulder we had the long flash with Royal Armoured Corps in red and yellow. Red and yellow were the flashes of the armoured corps. Red, of course, was the flashes of the infantry. Dark blue and red were the flashes of the artillery. Each section had its own colours. Red and yellow, the long flash Royal Armoured Corps, the yellow lanyard on your right shoulder, you were easily recognised, and the yellow blancard, belt and gaiters. You were easily picked out when you were walking out, almost identical with the 54th, except that they had the green lanyard where we had the yellow. We arrived in mid-November. We were given the first 5 weeks, I said, was taken up with life with square bashing and things like that. But we were issued with pistols. They were the Webley and the Smith and Wesson. I was given a Smith and Wesson 6-shot revolver, which we had a small shooting range, which we did a little bit of shooting, not very much. But we did have a rifle shooting, and we had to pass our rifle test, which was to shoot into a group, 5 rounds into a group at 200 yards. It didn't matter whereabouts on the target you hit, as long as they were all at more or less in the same place. We had to aim for a 4-inch group, which I did, and it's then marked in the back of your paybook. Part one. Also in there you had all your inoculations were in there as well. That was your paybook part one. Your paybook part two was to do with actually collecting your pay and how much you got. Shortly after we arrived, because Christmas was coming up, December, so I was due to get my first taste of Christmas in the army. I was at home by this time. I'd got my sleeping out pass, I think. But rather than have a Christmas dinner at home, I was advised by the company, you want to come up and have your dinner with us on Christmas Day, which I did do. And the officers, of course, all wait on the troops that day of the year. Well, in my regiment, it was 2 days. It was the Balaclava Day, which was the charge of the Light Brigade. The officers looked after you that day. It was a free day, and they waited on you at all meals. And it was the same on Christmas Day. We had beer and cigarettes at the table, and as much as we could eat, turkey and things. And I don't think I've ever eaten such a huge meal. It was fantastic. I don't think we could hardly walk after it. So that was Christmas Day, 42. All the tests that we did, this rifle shooting, pistol shooting, driving, your wireless, you were marked, as I said, after 8 weeks, the signal sergeant major came, tested you to see how fast, and gave you general questions on changing valves and on your 19 set. Also, in the D&M, the driving and maintenance wing, you were tested again twice, midway between the course and at the end of the course, and you were asked questions like, if you see black smoke coming out of your exhaust, what does that tell you? Well, of course, it tells you that you're using burning fuel, too much fuel. And if you've got blue smoke, you're burning oil. Things like that. And what would you do if your engine started to splutter? And where would you look first? It was what faults, how to diagnose faults in an engine. That was another test, and all these tests were written down, and they went to the next regiment that you were going to, telling them how good you were at certain things, so that they could decide where to eventually fit you into the regiment. On Sundays, I made quite a lot of friends up on the 61st. My grandmother always had a house full of soldiers, especially at weekends. So a lot of my friends would meet at my grandmother's on a Sunday afternoon, have a cup of tea and a piece of cake, and the more they were there, the happier she was. And she was a lady then about 76, and she just loved to have the house full. The house was full of soldiers, and lovely people there were, marvellous boys.
Was that common in Barnet Castle?
That was common, yes. When the first troops came, it was the South Wales Borders Infantry, and she had a chap staying there. There weren't any camps here then, so they lived in all buildings, old mills, any empty quarters, empty halls, they filled them up. So some of them were in civilian houses, especially the married ones. So Mr. Tom Clark, a corporal, lived at my grandmother's with his wife and small child. He was a Londoner. And when he went away, his wife stayed in Barnet Castle, and I think for the duration. She eventually got her own house. When they went, the North Staffs came, so boys from the North Staffs. I don't know how they eventually ended up there, but I think it was more or less by word of mouth. Well, I think that's about all from the 61st. Eventually we got paraded and told we were moving on, and four of us left the 61st to go to the 1318th Hussars. I think that's about, covers the 61st.
We finished the last tape talking basically about the Sherman tank. You got Shermans, didn't you, when you got to
When we first arrived at the regiment, we had Covenanters. They were the British tank. And I never knew until last week where those Covenanters went. But a chap I was talking to on the phone said, oh, we took the Covenanters, I was with them, the day before St. Patrick's Day, which must have been February, we took them to Leeds from Skipton and gave them to the Irish Guards. They suddenly go and you don't know what's happened to them. And that's where they went.
We've talked a little about the Shermans. Can we go on a little bit further about them before we move on? Can you describe the internal arrangement inside the tank for crew and equipment and so on?
They were very, very small. You never had enough room. The two drivers sat in the front of the tank, away from everybody else. In the turret, which was a round box, there was three people in: the crew commander, the gunner, and the wireless operator. The wireless operator sat at the back, facing the rear, and in front of him was a ledge, and this was immediately below the turret. When you stepped in, you stepped on his seat. You had to stand on his seat to come into the turret. And when you got out, you climbed on his seat to get out. And his set was in front of you. In action, we had, all round his set was tins of food and God knows what, cigarettes, and that was like a sort of a public storage place. Everything seemed to collect there. All the bits and pieces seemed to collect there. Just behind that, was outside the tank, was the two aerials, a small one, and which was for the B set, talking between the tanks, and the tall one, the 6 foot one, just made of copper tubing, which was to send up to 20 miles. Turning round to face the gun from the wireless operator, the gunner sat on the right hand side on a small stool, and he had a little periscope. He also had a telescopic sight, if you know what I mean, with crossed wires, which he, and that was to aim at when he was looking through there, he was actually looking through his gun to see what it was going to hit. And that's how he aimed his gun, telescopic thing. On the other side of the gun, which was in the middle, right in the middle of the turret, a huge breech block, sat the crew commander. He could do any job in the tank. He was taught every, and so, more or less we could eat as well, but he had the finer points of things like map reading and all the sort of how can I put it, movements, strategy, which we didn't know much about. So you were very, very cramped for space. You couldn't lie down, you could hardly stand up. You were very, very cramped for space.
What rank or ranks might a tank commander hold?
A tank commander in a troop, a tank commander would, if he was a troop leader, the leader of the five tanks, it would be a lieutenant. In an ordinary troop, he would be a lieutenant. Then there would probably be two sergeants, and then two corporals, and that would be the troop. And if the crew commander got killed, if he was an officer, another officer would take his place. The wireless operator would take his place. He was the second man down, regardless of rank. If he was killed, the wireless operator would take over the duties of the crew commander until a new one was brought. Occasionally, a trooper, wireless operator, would be made up. It happened in one occasion where the crew commander was severely wounded. He wasn't killed. Happy Hammond, was severely wounded, and his wireless operator was made up there and then to full corporal to take over the tank. He wasn't replaced.
Then you say you had the two drivers. Why two
You had two drivers. One was operating he was a left-hand drive on a Sherman, so he sat on the left-hand side, and on the right-hand side was a machine gun and a second driver. So when you went driving, you were using the machine gun, which was a BSA.
And you alternated, did you, the two drivers?
You alternated. Well, there was always the first driver or the second driver, in most cases, especially if you'd got a replacement. If you got a replacement driver, he wouldn't be as good as the original. So the original did most of the driving, or all the driving, if you were in action, or if you were driving at night. The other chap would be allowed to drive coming out of action or in daylight, when it wasn't so important. Because driving was you were more or less driving blind all the time. You were obeying the instructions of the crew commander. I remember on one long march, what we called a march, like it was actually a long drive, and it was a night-time drive, when we drove from Nijmegen down into the Ardennes arriving on the 10th of November 1944. It was an all-night drive. The crew were dozing, except for the driver and the crew commander. And when we made a halt, I was dozing off, and only to be wakened up in about 5 minutes later by the driver advance and waking me up in my earphones. But when we arrived in there in the morning about 3 o'clock, that was a terrible night with one little light, tail light in front to follow. And as you got tired, very tired, it seemed to come and go from you. And we pulled in at 3 o'clock, and I just pulled my boots off, wrapped a blanket round my feet, and went straight to sleep. And another blanket round me, went straight to sleep. And the crew commander had said, "Don't wake Ronnie up, let him sleep." And eventually I was woken up at 10 o'clock in the morning with a cup of tea, a pint pot of tea, and we went into action that afternoon across the border into Germany. This was the Ardennes, the beginning of the Ardennes, where we'd been sent down to reinforce the Americans.
We'll come to that, of course. So pretty tiring job driving.
It was very tiring.
Was there some tricks which enabled you to stay awake or stop from dozing whilst the...
We tea, I think, was the only trick we knew. Every time we made a halt, it was always a cup of tea. We always, what we called, brewed up, have a brew. Tea was the only thing that kept us going, tea and a cigarette. And the part of it, when you were in action, you didn't get a lot of sleep, because you're standing down and standing to and waiting to go in, and then we would go in at 2 o'clock, and then it was cancelled because the regiment on our right hadn't quite got there, or something had happened which we didn't know anything about, and so you stood down, only to be wakened up again at 4:30. To say we're going in at six and things like that. Sleep was very, very hard to come by, so that when you did eventually get a rest, which wasn't very often, you did manage to get a sleep, not as much as you would like even then. But we're getting ahead of the...
You mentioned the machine gun, which was another weapon on the tank itself.
Yes.
Where was the ammunition kept for that?
That was kept in at the side of the turret for that, at the side of the driver's hatch for that. At both sides there was a ledge. For the driver there was the 5 switches to start his engine. You started the it was a 5 banks of skits of 6. So you had to switch each bank on, it was like 5 engines. And you put 5 different switches, and the same ledge was there, but without that facility, and that was where the ammunition was kept in the cases in there.
But it didn't start it like a car with a key, the engine?
No, buttons. But you had to start each one, you know. You had to switch them all on to start. And it was a Chrysler engine, a 30-cylinder Chrysler petrol engine, and it did about 1.25 miles to the gallon.
Was it terribly noisy inside the tank while you were moving?
Not really, because the engine was at the back of the... The engine was right at the back of the tank. But what you could hear, it, the engine, in your earphones. It came through the engine. It affected your radio. Even though there was a screening and bonding, which was... The wires were all screened. If you know what screening and bonding, it's like plated metal to protect against that, it still came through. And when you change gear, you got in your earphones from your radio. You couldn't avoid it. Everything was metal.
And that didn't make it difficult to understand an order being given at the same time.
Not really. No. You had to saw one out from the other. You could hear that all right. I mean, an order given inside that was very loud, in your earphones.
The weapons swiveled, obviously.
Yes.
Or turned, as the case may be. How about deflections coming? How far down could you bring your weapon to hit something very close to you? I'm thinking in terms
not very,
infantry and so forth.
Not very far down. The machine gun at the front hardly came down at all, and the gun on the main armament, what we call the main armament, was 75. That came down probably 10 yards in front of the tank.
You wouldn't be wanting to fire that gun that close.
Oh, no. But it had to dip down for cleaning it out. And you had a long rod with a cleaning rod that 2 men pushed in and out to clean it, which was every day when you were shooting.
I think you said on the last tape that... the shells for the Sherman were in boxes round the turret.
Yes.
What happened to the empty cases?
They were thrown out. Nothing else you could do with them. Of course, this is in action. You would never dream of throwing anything away in England. They were all collected up. But you couldn't do much about them in action. They came into a bag. a bag about the size of a coal sack, made of tarpaulin, a green tarpaulin bag that fitted onto the breech, and as the empty shell cases went into there, and then when it got full, you emptied them out and started again. You couldn't have them all over the floor. In England, of course, they were all collected up and used for scrap, sent away for scrap or whatever, for recycling.
How did you manage with the physical functions if you were tied inside the tank for long hours?
That's a very good question. We had jerry cans to fill up with petrol and diesel. Some of them had diesel. The jerry can had a red ticket on the handle, a red metal disc, and the diesels had a black. You had to be very careful if you were filling up at night that you didn't get the can mixed up. There was also a square tin, very thin, that you could open with a knife, very thin, that held 4 gallons of petrol. And we cut them off halfway down, knocked the edges over because they were very sharp, and used them as a washing facility, with two wires on, two holes for a wire, and hang them on the hook at the back of the tank that we would use for towing anything. And that you always saw a tank with one of those swinging at the back. You would use one of those if you were in action and couldn't get out of the tank to do whatever you had to do in there, because it was as much as your life was worth sometimes if you were getting shelled to get out of the tank. I've seen chaps that were out of the tank and it was suddenly shelling, and one young chap made an effort to climb into the tank, and he was killed climbing in, or killed on the tank itself, instead of dropping flat like the regulars would do. There was more casualties among the replacements than the regular men, because it was just that they knew just what to do. As soon as something happened, you just dropped flat. You didn't try to climb up a tank because shrapnel would just cut you in half. So that's what you did. You attended to the wants of nature. If in doubt, do it inside, you know.
And presumably throw it out when you get the chance.
Yes. Yes.
What other equipment did a tank carry? I'm thinking in terms of camouflage or what you carried on the backs of the tanks and so on.
Well, before we left England, we had spare track, links of track, all links of track, which we got welded onto the front of the driver and the second driver. It was a slope at the front where the driver's sitting, and we had spare track welded on there as an extra little bit of protection. All the tanks had that on. We had a camouflage net, which was just a big netting with little bits of material tied in little bows all over it, and that was draped over the tank when we were packed up. We tried to get under a tree to save all this, you know, from protection from the air. Fortunately, from the air, we didn't really need it because we didn't encounter many enemy planes. There were very, very few and far between. But we still had to go through the motions of hiding away. And even to the even if we were going to be any length of time, to dig a pit to put the nose of the tank in. That happened to me twice, I think. It was hard work digging into a hillside to protect your tank, your tracks.
Without going into any actual details themselves, speaking generally about your tanks, the hull down situation. Did you have to practice that?
Yes. Well, that was just the hull down. Was just a matter of getting your tank as low down as possible into a sunken road, or behind a hedge, so that you weren't sticking up. They were pretty high, as Sherman, not like the British tanks. The Valentine was very low, and the Covenant of the Crusades also low, flat turrets, flat engines, the horizontally opposed but the Sherman had a radial engine, and consequently it was a pretty high tank, and you had to get as low down as you could.
Did you have a situation where
sometimes you had to dig down? Yes, yes. Twice we had to dig right in to get them down as far as we could. We used to sleep underneath the tanks for about 6 weeks after D-Day, and then a C squadron tank that was in a field at the bottom of a hill sank during the night and killed 4 people underneath it. So from then the order came that in future no more sleeping under the tanks, except if you're on a hard road.
Again, under normal circumstances, of training circumstances, they would obviously differ probably in battle. What was the movement pattern of a troop? Was it arrow shape, or how did you move into action?
It all depended on your terrain, of course. The troop leader would lead. From a squadron, you would get the third troop would lead. That A squadron would lead, or B squadron would lead, that third troop would lead, or first troop, or whatever troop would take the lead, and of course the troop officer's tank from that troop would lead that troop in. It could be that C squadron would stand down, in or vice versa. It depended on who went in. At Mont Pinkin, it was only two tanks of A squadron that managed to get a foothold on Mont Pinkin. Just two tanks, quite by accident, by chance. They saw the chance and a track, and they headed for it. And there was only two tanks, but it was A squadron that had got two troops of A squadron had would be told to take to try and get up, and they did.
Was there any kind of indicator or sign on the tank which showed it was different, that was the troop leader's tank as against your other four?
No. They all had numbers, of course. You knew your troop leader's tank. The only difference, for A squadron, all A squadron tanks would have a triangle on with a point upwards. B squadron would have a square. And C squadron would have a circle, and HQ would have a diamond, and that was on the side of the tank. That's how you knew which squadron was. Well, that's the only thing we had.
Pennants? Did you fly pennants?
We had pennants, a red and yellow pennant. Not a regimental pennant, just the red and yellow. They were just tied to you at first. A lot of them got lost and so forth, but this was from the old cavalry days. As you were saying earlier, a carryover from the cavalry pennants, from the lances.